Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Adventures of Super Cop. Faster than a hijacked airplane, more powerful than thousands of anti-Wall Street protesters, able to bust teenage pot smokers with a single frisk. And who, disguised as a mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper? Well, no, they're not really disguised as reporters. But we have a real reporter. I'm not sure how mild-mannered. And a former cop college professor to talk about the three NYPD stories in the news this week. There's the handling of the weekend Wall Street protests, still raising questions. The memo that seems to reverse a basic practice of stop and frisk, reported by WNYC exclusively, that resulted in thousands of unnecessary marijuana arrests, and the revelation by Police Commissioner Ray Kelly that the NYPD has the capacity to shoot hijacked airplanes out of the sky.
It's something that's on our radar screen. I mean, in an extreme situation, we would have some means to take down a plane.
Commissioner Kelly on 60 Minutes. We'll hear more of that shortly. WNYC's Elsa Chang has covered the pot bust story all year and got the scoop on Friday about the change in policy or apparent change. She will raise that question. Eugene O'Donnell from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former NYP detective and prosecutor, also joins us. Welcome back both. Hi.
Thank you.
Good morning, Brian.
Now, folks, when Elsa was here earlier in the year, we asked for calls from people who have gone to jail after being stopped without displaying marijuana and the police discovering a little marijuana subsequently in their pockets. Here's one of those calls to refresh your memory. This is JP, who actually called us from Rikers Island.
November of 2009, I was taking a walk with my then-girlfriend in the afternoon in Bedford-Stuyvesant on Franklin and Lefferts. And I happened to have marijuana on my person, but a uniformed police officer was standing across the street from us, and he happened to observe me giving a handshake to a friend of mine. Now, I'm white, and he's black. We honestly did not make a transaction, but he assumed we did, and he ran up on us and searched the three of us.
Caller from Rikers Island, at the time, in April, serving a four-month sentence. So, Elsa Chang, what did the NYPD just decide to change, if anything?
Well, it depends who you ask when you use the word change. The NYPD has said on the record since we scooped the story last week that this internal memo, it's an operations order issued by Ray Kelly, isn't a change in policy. It's a reiteration of current police policy, a reiteration of what the existing state law says. And that is, if someone possesses marijuana that's not in public view, you are not supposed to charge that person with a misdemeanor. That is not a crime. Instead, you're supposed to issue a violation and just give the person a ticket and a fine. Kelly in the memo acknowledged that there may be occasions where officers find marijuana on people either by searching them, pulling out marijuana from their clothes, or ordering them to empty their pockets, and then the person pulls out their marijuana into public view. And Kelly specifically says in those cases, the officer is not to charge that person with a crime.
And it's that ordering to empty your pockets that apparently is so, so common. The law only allows for an arrest if someone is displaying marijuana publicly. That's the law. But the police stop otherwise law-abiding people and tell them to empty their pockets if they're doing a stop and frisk. And that order causes a little bag or a couple of joints or whatever to be displayed. And then they're arrested for displaying marijuana openly. The police department now admits that narrative, I guess, right?
Well, certainly in the memo, it says the specific circumstances in question. The memo starts out that questions have been raised about the processing of certain marijuana arrests. And it says the specific circumstances in question include occasions where the officers recover marijuana pursuant to a search of the subject's person or upon direction of the subject to surrender the contents of his or her pockets or other closed container. And then it says, quote, a crime will not be charged to an individual who is requested or compelled to engage in the behavior that results in the public display of marijuana. So in a way, he does acknowledge that these occasions do happen.
And apparently, Professor O'Donnell, these occasions happen a lot. There are actually, maybe, Elsa, you have those numbers?
Well, if you talk to defense lawyers, the estimates are anywhere between 2/3 to 3/4 of the marijuana possession cases that they see involve individuals who never had their marijuana in public view when they encountered those officers.
Two-thirds to three-fourths.
Those are the estimates.
Of tens of thousands of arrests for this a year in New York City. So that is, Professor O'Donnell, tens of thousands of people, if those defense attorney estimates are right, and we, you know, acknowledge that they're defense attorney estimates, are getting criminal records for having tiny bits of pot in their pocket that are not being displayed, that cops then compel them to display. Is this news to you?
Well, maybe not ultimately getting criminal records, but getting arrested and being held in custody.
Right.
And it is news to me that there's that kind of, I mean, I'm aware of the nuance. I didn't know it was practiced so commonly. So hopefully the DAs have been on top of this. They should be. And there should be some reviews by those folks. And hopefully this operations order will clarify this going forward.
From what you understand of the operations order, as Elsa has reported it, someone apparently leaked the document, you know, and it got out, and they're saying, well, this is just a reiteration of standard practice. Does it sound to you like Ray Kelly is actually responding to all the criticism that's been generated through Elsa's previous reporting and other things over this year?
Yeah, I think they're extremely conscious of the reporting, and I think they're trying to right-size the enforcement. And I also think, in fairness to them, and to Commissioner Kelly in particular, who takes an oath to do everything creatively to keep the city safe, that you do want them to be aggressive. We've lived in a city that's been very safe for more than a decade, decade and a half now, so maybe we take it for granted. So you do want them to push the margins. Obviously, some of this marijuana enforcement, a lot of people were raising questions about the level of that enforcement and the idea of punishment being applied unilaterally. These folks are not going to get jail at the end result, but they're getting jail up front with no judicial stamp of approval. Essentially, they're going to jail first, and then the determination's being made. So those things have to be weighed. And there are people all over the place, including police people, who wonder about some of the levels of enforcement. That said, I think it is important the commissioner continue to push the envelope, and that good reporting and good opinion, people that weigh in about these things, legislators, the city council, the DAs, they all be in the mix also.
The Times wrote a strong editorial about this today. It said, for one thing, that they thought this is too little and too late from Ray Kelly, but it also gave some history, and that is that the statute, the decriminalization of marijuana in the 70s, was supported by district attorneys because they believed it would free the police to fight serious crimes. That changed, the Times reminds us, in the mid-1990s when the city began emphasizing street stops as an important part of its policing approach. So since 1996, the city has taken more than 500,000 people into custody for the lowest level marijuana charge, according to a study by Harry Levine, a Queens College sociologist who has tracked the data closely. 500,000 people since 1996. From 1981 through 1985, the total was 33,000. So, Elsa, that is such an astronomical increase in the number of people arrested for low-level marijuana possession. Obviously, something really changed in terms of policy in the mid-90s during Giuliani.
Absolutely. And if you talk to academics who studied this issue closely, they will say it's the stop and frisk. If you look at the vast majority of marijuana arrests across the city, they take place in the neighborhoods filled with police. These are Black and Latino neighborhoods like East Harlem, Brownsville, the South Bronx. These are the precincts where the most stop and frisks happen. And that's what absolutely just doesn't make sense. These are not the people you would expect to be walking around openly displaying their drugs in public view, because we're talking about guys who are used to getting stopped and frisked all the time. They're not stupid enough to be carrying around their drugs in the open. So it defies common sense to say that the vast majority of people who are openly displaying their drugs in New York City live in the most heavily policed precincts. But if you look at NYPD arrest data, that's the picture they paint.
But here's Police Commissioner Kelly. This is an excerpt from the piece you reported in the spring when some version of what you said, I think, was put to him, and his response.
Marijuana is against the law. Smoking marijuana. Officers encounter those situations in the street, they take action. If anyone thinks that's inappropriate, they should petition the state legislature to change the law.
Whoa, ho, ho.
Well, What Kelly says is technically true. Marijuana is against the law, and you either get a violation if it's in your pocket or you get a misdemeanor if you're displaying it in public view. But the issue isn't people wanting to legalize marijuana. It's about if marijuana is against the law, then let's arrest people according to the confines of that law. The issue is if you find people who are possessing marijuana, but the marijuana is in the pocket, shoe, sock, mm-hmm. underwear, crotch of the person, mm-hmm. that person should not be charged with a misdemeanor.
Professor O'Donnell, as a former prosecutor, do you know the law specifically enough to know if there is an exemption for somebody who displays marijuana publicly because he is compelled to do so for unrelated reasons by a police officer?
Yeah, I'm not aware of an exemption. I think that the prosecutor, in exercising discretion and getting the facts in the complaint room, should exercise judgment and perhaps decline to prosecute based on what the facts are. I would, though, say that what the commissioner is saying there, he's alluding to, is also apropos to stop and frisk, which is notwithstanding people's – you hear these reports about folks unhappy about these policies, the likelihood is the public opinion and public consensus largely continues to, at least with stop and frisk, endorse that, particularly in the neighborhoods that are more dangerous. And then with marijuana, I don't see anybody knocking down the doors in Albany to repeal those laws. So there is a little bit of a rub there in terms of public sentiment.
Well, there is a bill that's been introduced in Albany to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana possession in public view to get rid of that lowest level misdemeanor charge. It was proposed by Hakeem Jeffries, Assemblyman Hakeem Jeffries, as well as State Senator Mark Grisanti within weeks, actually, after the WNYC investigation came out in April. And the stated rationale for that proposed law is that it would reduce incentives for police officers to conduct improper searches and conduct unlawful stops in order to make more misdemeanor marijuana arrests.
In public view would mean what? In that case, would it then be legal or further decriminalized to smoke a joint in public?
If that law passes, it would indeed be legal to smoke a joint in public.
Here's a police officer calling in. John in the Bronx, thank you so much. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Real quick, this has always been a gray area with the public view. There are legal considerations with custodial interrogations and things of that nature. However, this is not police officers falsely testifying or falsely arresting people. These people did have marijuana in their pockets. These people did produce the marijuana and show it in public view to the cops. This is not something that should be brought against the cops. I think what's not being mentioned is in the last 10 years, the dramatic reduction in crime that we've had in this city. And a lot of that is because of quality of life enforcement. For the first 8 years of the past 10, quality of life enforcement was heralded as one of the greatest achievements of the New York City Police Department. But in the last 2 years, with the reduction or the repeal of the Rockefeller drug laws, with the controversy over stop, question, and frisk, with this, the morale of the police officers in the street has plummeted lower than I've ever seen it. And we're seeing the results, and nobody's mentioning this, we're seeing the results in the historic levels of violence that we're now seeing in Brooklyn, in the Bronx, and all over the city.
John,
there is a correlation.
I hear you. And let me, and we'll get our guests to respond to that, but do you think, since stop and frisk is really about getting guns off the street, that if the policy were to lighten up with respect to arresting people who are found with small amounts of marijuana and no weapon, that would reduce safety on the streets in any way if marijuana was just
Absolutely.
Sort of taken out of the equation?
Brian, right now, if there's a shooting in a street corner and the police respond, they find 20 kids there, and they're all legally frisked because they're in the area of a violent crime, and they come up with marijuana on a handful of them.
Mm-hmm.
That handful is off the street, unable to retaliate. Even though they haven't been proven to be involved in that crime, the message is sent out to that area, listen, they're out here. They're enforcing everything. You can't be out here. And the other thing that's not being said, the way around this, don't carry marijuana. I mean, you know, instead of blaming the cops for doing their job and functioning in somewhat of a gray area, nobody's saying don't carry weed.
Right.
Weed
but
is illegal.
Illegal.
And
but
then
the other thing,
Brian, is if we further decriminalize it so you can smoke a joint in the street, the result of that is going to be an increase in violence. You're going to see police officers handcuffed from doing their job. Imagine the scene where you have a police officer in Manhattan or the Bronx walking down the street, unable to stop somebody from smoking marijuana on the street corner. You can stop somebody for drinking a beer in the street corner. You can bring them in and you can arrest them if they don't have if they don't have proper ID.
So I understand. So that's your argument against that proposed law. Also, talk about John's interpretation, the officer's interpretation of the current situation and how it would reduce safety to do what I guess this new policy might even do.
Right. I'm glad that John called in. I mean, this is the NYPD's position, that the continual targeting of low-level offenses in the end reduces violent crime. And certainly, if you look at statistics, they support at least, without being able to prove causation, that we have seen a huge crime drop in the city. If you look at, say, like the 46th precinct, that was the precinct of one of the characters in my story, one of the men that I profiled, they've seen murder drop 85% in the last 20 years, and it's one of the precincts with the highest level of stop and frisk and the highest number of marijuana arrests. However, there has been no academic study that definitively proves that stop and frisk or more marijuana arrests directly causes a reduction in violent crime.
There has been empirical research that shows that enforcement of low level quality of life and offenses does reduce the level of violence. So if you're going to split hairs about stop, question, frisk and marijuana possession and whether or not they reduce the level of violence, you really can't do it because the data has been studied. But when you look at low-level quality of life enforcement, that has been empirically shown to reduce the level of violence
all
over the country.
So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think there actually is a valid academic debate whether that's true. There are studies saying one thing and studies saying another thing, but no study definitively proves that that's the case. But I do want to address one point you made, that you had said that these marijuana arrests get guys off the streets and then they won't commit other crimes. Well, the interesting thing about marijuana arrests is that a majority of these guys that get processed for these marijuana arrests end up getting a lesser charge after they go through the court system. They get the violation. So they get arrests on their record, but they end up leaving with this violation. And it's this whole circular journey. The city, according to the Drug Policy Alliance, spends about $75 million a year effectuating these arrests. But if we're getting guys, released immediately with these non-criminal violations anyway, what was the point of it all?
John, we're going to let you go in a minute, but take another 30 seconds and answer that question.
Sure. First of all, a number of these arrests, even if they were for the violation, would still go through because of the lack of identification on the people that are arrested. So that hasn't been determined. How many of these people would have qualified for the ticket but can't get a ticket because they don't have verifiable identification? Second of all, when you split hairs about the arrest itself, when you look at the low-level quality of life enforcement and what it did back in the beginning of the 90s for this city, there's a definite correlation. To say now that the violence has dropped low enough that you can't determine a correlation between the arrests made now for low-level quality offenses really doesn't hold much water.
John, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your call, officer, and we really appreciate it, and we hope you call us again. And just one last comment on this before we move on to the NYPD's ability to shoot planes out of the sky. Professor Eugene O'Donnell from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
John is right. In my view, the cops deserve a lot of the credit. They do insert themselves into these situations. And I must say, they insert themselves into legally dubious situations because the legislature, putting the marijuana law to the side for a moment, the legislature has seen fit to have a stop and frisk law, them and the courts, and I've said this many times, which is a complete farce. Nobody understands it. Nobody knows how to apply it. There's no agreement about what it is. And the cops go out to do the best they can, and they leave themselves open to being criticized regardless of the outcomes sometimes.
WNYC's Elsa Chang, who got the exclusive story on Friday about this memo to police officers from the department advising them not to arrest people if they stop and frisk them, ask them to empty their pockets, and then marijuana comes into display because it's the public display that makes it an arrestable crime. Elsa Chang got that scoop. Exclusively, it's been all over the press with credit to WNYC through her. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Still with us is Eugene O'Donnell, former police officer in the NYPD, former prosecutor and professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And here again is Commissioner Kelly on 60 Minutes on Sunday talking about the NYPD's capacity to shoot planes out of the sky if it's a World Trade Center type situation.
Are you satisfied that you've dealt with threats from aircraft, even light planes, model planes, that kind of thing?
Well, it's something that's on our radar screen. I mean, in an extreme situation, we would have some means to take down a plane.
Do you mean to say that the NYPD has the means to take down an aircraft?
Yes, I prefer not to get into the details, but obviously this would be in a very extreme situation.
You have the equipment and the training?
Yes.
So, Commissioner Kelly with Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes. Professor O'Donnell, this is not what we think of usually with the municipal police force, the cop on the beat. This is more the stuff of the Army or the Air Force or NORAD. Were you surprised by this revelation?
No, I'm not, because I think the commissioner has not only said but has done some remarkable things with that agency, and they do really now. They've had tanks for about 30 years, but you know they have a Navy, they have an Air Force. And he's also putting this issue front and center, this idea that you can talk about Homeland Security and talk around the local police departments, which has been a big mistake. The police, either as first alerters by getting information from the community and also as first responders, they have to be figured front and center in these equations. And the reality is that even with NORAD, even with scrambling fighter jets, the likelihood, and we certainly hope there won't be any future attacks on the city, the likelihood is it's the cops and FDNY that are going to be right out there immediately. It will be their responsibility to handle these things. And when the feds come in, very often the likelihood is these events will be over.
Alex in Queens is calling in as a former air defense artillery officer. And, Alex, we really appreciate you chiming in. You're on WNYC.
Well, thank you very much. I just wanted to bring up the point that in all likelihood, it'll be, I guess what he's talking about would be Stinger missiles, which is, you know, nothing classified or anything about that. But it would just seem two things about that. One, the devastation that would be caused by shooting down an airliner with a Stinger missile in the heavily populated urban center of New York City could quite easily be worse than whatever the bad guys who actually had the vehicle, you know, would do. Mm-hmm. It would, or at least it would be very comparable. And two, it doesn't necessarily have to be within the New York City police force directly. The New York City police working, everybody knows, with the FBI, that's very well known. But they're also working with all sorts of other, you know, CIA, all sorts of other lettered agencies, and JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command. And it would be very easy for maybe a 10-man, 20-man detachment of United States Army or somebody to be, say, hey, you're now off-conned out to New York Police Department. Good luck with that. And if they need you, you do what they tell you to do.
But so, if we're talking about an actual 9/11 situation, then the point that Professor O'Donnell was making is that the NYPD, even the fire department, they're the first responders. They're here. They're all over the streets of the city. By the time that the Army or the Air Force could scramble and get into place, it may well be too late. The judgment call would be the same as to whether it would cause more harm than good. So why not leave it in the hands of the arguably more nimble, at least closer to the situation, NYPD? Alex?
Well, for two reasons, I would say most notably. Number one, the training that's required. It's one thing to learn how to fire a Stinger missile. It's another thing to, you know, set up a Stinger missile trap, to understand that, you know, you have to be in this area, otherwise you're not going to have a clear line of sight. You're not going to be able to get tone on the vehicle or anything like that. It's basically not just knowing what the capabilities of the weapon are, but the actual utility of the weapon and of how it's supposed to be used in an operational setting.
Alex,
the second part.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say the second part of that is that it could be United States military personnel, but they could be working with New York Police Department. So it could be saying, hey, you know, Frank, you're working with the New York Police Department, even though you're, you know, a United States Army sergeant.
And I guess we don't know if that's not happening or if some retired people, you know, from the actual military are the ones being engaged to do this. But, Alex, I really appreciate your experience and your call. Professor O'Donnell, you know, to tie in yet a third story here, we're getting a lot of people posting on our Facebook page some version of this, which ties it into the arrests and the netting and the pepper spray at the anti-Wall Street protest on the weekend, and making the point such as, Adam on Facebook writes, they can't manage to handle pepper spray like responsible adults. Should we really trust them with rocket launchers?
Well, I mean, you don't want to be unfair here. These are discrete events and discrete conversations. And in terms of the protests, obviously, it's a vital issue that people be able to assemble and peaceably make their point. But the reality is the police are dealing now, and I'm not saying this is a cap, because I don't want to be unfair. Some of these protesters, I haven't seen these protesters on any videos doing anything that looks unlawful to me. But the reality is some of these protesters do, in some other context, do look for confrontation with the police, look to spark, the police lashing out and provoke events, and that becomes quite a bit more complicated. There's a lot of people that are, in parts of some of these movements, they're, want to have a million-hit video on the, that they put in cyberspace right, with some police officer doing something.
Well,
so,
from what you've seen of the videos and press reports and anything else you can glean, and with your experience, what can you tell happened on Saturday?
I think the cops at this point, the cops are day in, day out on the nonviolent, non-problematic demonstrations. That's a piece of cake. It's a no-brainer. These are really difficult things to police because you've got folks there. It's a private piece of property. You've got people staying overnight. It is in the financial district. You have tourists all over the place. There's all kinds of concerns about traffic and mobility. And some number of those people, I think, want to provoke a confrontation. So that becomes a completely different event. I think also the police get better at these as they do more of them, so they skill up. And I think also that this is a very difficult thing for the police in the sense that their frontline commanders have to be out there right on the lines alongside with rank-and-file people. And, you're never far away from potentially a confrontation that can at least look embarrassing when it's caught on tape.
What about the use of that netting, that mesh netting that seemed to, pen the whole lot of protesters into a certain area? And I think some people were kind of rebelling against that. If they looked to be gesturing wildly, they felt like, trapped in a cage. Is that a common procedure?
Yeah, it's becoming more and more common. I think the thing with the police commanders have to decide is how to calibrate their response. And obviously, at the present moment, are they going to try to remove these folks or just let them stay there? Will it become a national event? Will it become a rallying cry if they try to move in? Is it more in this situation? So they have to calibrate it sort of minute to minute. And hopefully the vast majority of the people that are assembled there just want to make a very important point, which is a vital point at this time. But mixed in with them may be people that are there to cause trouble. And then I think you'll see what the police, their tactic is to use the public order offenses in the New York State Penal Law, which is a lot of different kinds of offenses, and to make arrests. And sometimes with these things, making arrests rapidly, legal arrests, preempts bigger problems. Mm-hmm. One thing we learned in London, by the way, I don't know if anybody studied the lessons of London, but folks across the political spectrum don't want to see violence. From the far left to the far right, I think most people, if you saw the reaction after the riots in England, throughout England, mm-hmm. there was a lot of outrage across the board. So hopefully it will be nonviolent. And also hopefully the police will not try to content manage what people are doing and, will not try to interfere with the message or the right of people to assemble and to make their point.
Thank you very much. Eugene O'Donnell, professor of law and police science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former police officer, former prosecutor. Always appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, George and Angela go out to dinner. Who picks up the check for Greek debt? Stay with us.